Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin in a moment and examine the likely consequences of the referendum underway to divide Africa's largest country, Sudan, in two, with the new country in the south possessing 80% of the oil and the old country in the north controlling the oil pipelines. Sondra Hale, a professor of anthropology at UCLA, who has studied Sudan for the last 5 decades, joins us to assess the possibility of a new civil war or wars in a country associated with genocide, with a leader in the north under indictment from the International Criminal Court. Then we will look into the issue of gun control that is being reflexively revived in the wake of yet another massacre by a deranged American with a handgun. Saul Cornell, the author of A Well-Regulated Militia, The Founding Fathers and the Origins of Gun Control in America, joins us to discuss the disconnect between a majority of Americans, including gun owners, who want gun control, and a Congress actively thwarting law enforcement's efforts to investigate gun crimes, as well as a Supreme Court that has recently reversed the meaning of the Second Amendment. Then finally, we'll get an update on the latest news from Tucson with Dan Gibson, a reporter for the Tucson Daily, who has been covering the shooting tragedy since it happened and will fill us in on today's developments in Tucson and in Arizona as the rest of the nation argues over whether this latest massacre was about toxic politics or a tormented mind. And welcome to the program, Sondra Hale.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Good to be with you. And as I mentioned in the opening, there is a question here whether the country in the south, that where 80% of the oil is, will be essentially in a situation where the country in the north, where the pipes go, control the pipeline. So already that seems like if oil will be the means by which this country will survive, then I don't see how that arrangement's going to work.
Well, I mean, there are a number of other factors to consider. For sure, that seems to be a recipe for civil war, or certainly for civil strife. Seems to be a recipe for various kinds of conflicts here and there in the country. But it's not inevitable. It's not inevitable because both the leaders of the North and the South recognize that after many decades of civil war that absolutely drained both the North and the South, they really don't want a full-out civil war. However, that doesn't rule out the possibilities of conflicts by proxy, some pretty violent ones and some pretty serious ones. I'm not saying that we're not going to have another civil war. I'd be a fool to, you know, try to predict that sort of thing. But the likelihood that it'll be a full-out civil war is lower than one might think, considering how you just set up the question.
Well, I'm kind of puzzled about it because, you know, arguably there's a new form of colonialism going on in Africa, a hunt for resources or as opposed to for, you know, 18th century grandeur or whatever. The original motives, I'm sure the original motives for colonization were also about resources. But given that oil is an important resource, and I believe the Chinese have been developing oil in Sudan, I'm just puzzled as to why a country would split in two with oil in one part and then with the infrastructure, the pipelines, in another part. It seems fairly clear to me, and perhaps I'm wrong, but surely the leader in the north is not happy to do this or is not doing this necessarily willingly. So what's forcing this division?
Well, the Civil War had gone on for a very long time and, as I said, was absolutely bleeding the north. I think they had no choice but to come to the negotiating table, and the comprehensive peace agreement that was signed in 2005 assured the South that if matters were not reconciled, let's say, in a five-year period, that they would have a choice. that the South would have a choice and could become independent. But I don't think that the North miscalculated. I don't think they thought this would actually come about, that the referendum would actually be held. And I don't think that they really believed that Southerners would vote in such what will no doubt be overwhelming numbers, will vote for secession. Now, whether or not the North allows that, in quotes, to happen is another matter. And, of course, that's what's causing all of us Sudanists and Sudanese to sit on the edges of our seats. But, I mean, yes, of course he would not want to let that happen, he being Bashir, the president. But he's under enormous pressure from international forces, from the United States, from Europe, even from the Arab League, the African Unity. He's really under great pressure to not be the warmonger that he's accused of being by the International Criminal Court. So he has Sudan's whole reputation at stake. Everyone's watching. There are many things that would restrain him. I must admit that early in his regime, after 1989, he was not exactly a portrait of restraint, and certainly not in the way that he's conducted himself toward the South. But there are enough kinds of pressure. I mean, even George Clooney's collaboration with Google and Harvard to observe the borderlands, to make sure that there are no major troop movements and so on. Now, of course, this kind of organization can't prevent a civil war, but the mere fact that there's so much surveillance of all kinds now really puts the spotlight on northern Sudan. And in that sense, I think there's great hesitation to try to use any military force.
Again, I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with UCLA anthropology professor Sandra Hale, who has been studying, doing fieldwork in, and living in Sudan for over 50 years. She is the author of numerous books and articles, including Locating Sudan Studies, Gender Politics in Sudan, and the forthcoming book, Sudan's Killing Fields, Perspectives on Genocide. So this new country that appears to be being formed, obviously the referendum will go on, I think, for most of the week. It seems fairly at least preordained by all the reports I've read that the referendum will vote for a new country of about 10 million people, but it is larger than Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, and Uganda combined, and it contains very rich land, plenty of water, and a lot of resources, not the least of which is the oil that we've mentioned early. So on the surface, it should be viable. But on the other hand, apparently it is also one of the poorest, least educated, unhealthiest countries on the planet.
That's right. Very, very low. I mean, almost the entire infrastructure was eliminated, annihilated during the war, and that was a long-lasting war. So it took decades, but by the end of it, there was almost nothing left, except the kind of subsistence economy that had been going on for centuries. But even that was severely interrupted. As you said, there's a very low level of development that was left over from the colonial era. It's a legacy of the colonials and a legacy of the Northern Sudanese government. So it wasn't just the war that put southern Sudan, or what will, I guess, temporarily be called South Sudan. It wasn't just the war that put them so far behind. They were already behind going into the war. And so we have one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world, as you said, a very, very low level of education. It takes a long time to build up health services, as we should know in the United States. But anyway, to build up health services and to build up the educational system, to have enough educated people to run the country, this is going to take a very long time. However, they're going to have an enormous amount of international aid at their disposal. But, I know that they won't want to be that kind of state. They don't want to be the kind of state that is completely supported by outside money. The oil, even though the oil will bring in revenue, it will still be extremely difficult to overnight or in a year or 2 years or 5 years to build the society in a way that would make the state viable. Having said that, I have to say that even though I've lived in the North, this is where my best friends are, this is where most of my research has been done, where my affinities lie for mysterious reasons, but whatever, I'm still cheering for Southern Sudanese who see themselves as being liberated from oppression, and who could not cheer? And I have to admit that the years and years of racism and discrimination by Northerners against Southerners is something that's going to be very, very difficult to forget and forgive. Reconciliation is going to be extremely difficult. And that, you know, brings up the question of the relationship between the two Sudans once the South does declare its independence, which, by the way, can't be officially declared until, I believe, July 1st, because that under the terms of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. So there is a period of trying to feel out things, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what the international law. I don't know anything about the international law with regard to whether or not the South can just simply declare themselves independent before that deadline. But anyway, I think it's a kind of miraculous, cheerful day, for the South, but a very, very sad day for Sudan as a whole. And had South Sudan's great hero, John Garang, lived and not died in a fairly suspicious plane crash just after the signing of the CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, in 2005, things might have been quite different over these 5 years, because he was someone who believed in a unified socialist Sudan.
Again, I'm speaking with UCLA anthropologist Sondra Hale, who has studied Sudan for the past five decades, and we're talking about the emergence of the newest country in the world, which is essentially the result of splitting the largest country in Africa in two along north-south and largely Christian-Muslim lines. And we started out talking about the possibilities of civil war, or surrogate wars, or wars in plural. At the same time, there are these valuable resources. Again, trying to understand the viability of this state. If as I understand it, the most of these oil fields in the south, where 80% of the oil is in Sudan, have been developed by the Chinese. However, the main pipeline, the only pipeline, goes through the north. That's a situation somewhat reminiscent of what's going on in Russia, between Russia and Ukraine. I understand that there are also plans or discussions or whatever to have oil pipelines that go through Ethiopia to the port of Berbera in Somalia, or through Kenya. Is there anything to those plans that would, in other words, would make the South really independent, and presumably that would be something the North doesn't want?
Well, they're talking about such pipelines, of course, but they haven't been built and they haven't been negotiated, and so this is a long time off, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. However, one of the ways that these two countries can be held together, at least in cooperation, is that very pipeline. So we could see it as a negative, but we could also see it as a positive. That is, if the South agrees to, and they have been negotiating. I mean, we get clues that they're behind the scenes negotiation. But if the South were to give a significant percentage of the oil to the North, trading the use of the pipeline, this could be worked out. It could work. Whether it does or not is another matter. Whether they haggle over over the percentage, whether they, you know, haggle over whatever is a question. But that doesn't, that still means that that oil area of Abyei is still in difficulty because there are two contending groups in that oil area. The pastoralists, whom people are calling Arabs, the Masoria, and the settled farmers, a branch of the Dinka, southern Sudanese. And they are, I mean, much like the range wars in Sudan, much like any kind of, you know, many wars that we've seen between pastoralists and agriculturalists or settled people and nomadic people, this has been an ongoing conflict. But the Masoria claim that they have a right to the land because they have been grazing their cattle in that area for centuries, and the Dinka say that this is southern Sudan, this is our home. So this is one of the, this borderland area is one of the hot spots and something certainly to watch, as are all of the border areas. One of the things that in the international coverage of the Sudan conflict and in Clooney's PBS special and the articles that have been done about him and so on, he and others talk about the southern Sudan as Christian and animist or indigenous religions, and the completely overlooking a very large population of Muslims. I mean, this is the subtext of this is the anti-Arab, anti-Muslim bias of U.S. media and some European media. But the Muslims, there is a very large number of Muslims who live in those border areas and in the south, and these are people that are not even being talked about. So these are areas where I expect conflict and areas that needed to be tended to and, in fact, haven't been tended to, with the exception of talking about the oil in the borderlands. I think the northern government actually needed a few anthropologists as consultants, frankly. It might have clarified a number of things about just the social life, the intermarriage between Muslims and Christians, the intermarriage between northerners and southerners and so on in this very large border area. So these are our hot spots, and there are a number of others too, the Nuba Mountains, for example, which is somewhat divided in its affinities with the southern part of the Nuba Mountains having more of an affinity to be with the south, and the north quite the opposite.
Well, again, I'm speaking with UCLA anthropologist Sondra Hale, who studied Sudan for the past five decades. We're talking about the formation of this new country and why it's happening and how the resources will be divided. The President of the United States, of course, weighed in on the weekend with an op-ed in the New York Times. It's clearly something that the U.S. is watching closely. I've mentioned the influence of China. In 2010, Dennis Blair, then the United States Director of National Intelligence, told the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that among the world's unstable places in the next 5 years, a new mass killing or genocide is most likely to occur in southern Sudan. So Do you know why, where the DNI got that, the former DNI got that notion from? Is it?
Well, it's a fairly simplistic kind of guess.
Right.
And it's not as if there haven't been genocidal massacres in Sudan. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if we haven't seen genocide by attrition in areas like the Nuba Mountains or a war that looked like genocide in the south. This word genocide is thrown around a little bit too loosely, and in the book that that Laura Benn and I are co-editing on Sudan's Killing Fields, Perspectives on Genocide, a number of our contributors, a large number of whom are indigenous to the conflict areas that we've been discussing, they differ on whether or not we can call certain kinds of conflicts in Sudan genocide. But that aside, it has the look of genocide, so I don't want to get hung up on definitions of genocide. So the past certainly would give people clues that if things don't go well, these genocidal tendencies, if we can call them that for a moment, sounds pretty trivial, but anyway, these genocidal tendencies might emerge again. So anything could happen, and that's what has us on the edge of our seats. It's very difficult to predict. We're not clairvoyant. Even the old hands, as the British used to say, people have been following Sudan current events and historical events for a very, very long time. Of course they might have that idea, but because there's an enormous amount of animosity on both sides, lots of ingredients are there. The notions about racial superiority that many Northerners hold, the memory of slavery that Southerners hold, these are formulas for terrible conflict. But as I said early on, they've had a lot of it, and they know they don't need any more. They know that conflict is not going to serve them. And the Northern government knows that they did not win that civil war. So what would cause us to believe that they can win it, this one? So yes, oil may be a major factor. And many of these things that I've talked about and you've talked about can be major factors. But are they so naive as to think that they can win a civil war against the South? I don't think so. The South had one of the best organized guerrilla armies that we've seen. They were not only in the South, but they were moving north, mm-hmm. and that was one of the factors that caused the peace agreement to be signed, was that they were moving north. John Garang was head of the SPLM, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and Liberation Army. He was head of it, and he was moving north, talking about a unified socialist Sudan. I don't think the North can win against the Southern guerrilla movement. They know how to fight in their swamps, in the Sud. They know the terrain. I mean, it's like the U.S. and Vietnam. There was no way we could win that war.
Well, Sandra, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, but I thank you so much for joining us here on Background Briefing, Sandra Hale.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with UCLA anthropologist Sandra Hale, who studied Sudan for the past 5 decades. Let's take a brief break and return in a moment to talk about the history of the Constitution as it applies to gun control issues in the debate today.